Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Today marks 10 years since a massive explosion ripped through the Pike River mine. 29 men from the West Coast and around the world remain entombed there. A Royal Commission identified a total disregard by management for their welfare and led to sweeping changes of workplace safety rules. But still, none of those in charge have been held accountable. Now a team is slowly making its way down the 2.3-kilometre entry tunnel in the search for evidence that might lead to a prosecution. And although the chances are slim, the bodies of the men inside. Colin Young reports.
And in breaking news, the police in Greymouth say they're on their way to the Pike River coal mine after receiving reports of an explosion there. The mine's location...
So I've just been contacted by the police probably 5 minutes ago, and I'm heading up to the Pike River coal mine now, which is 46 k's out of Greymouth. It's not good news at all. They say that there are between 25 and 30 miners unaccounted for after a big explosion on the mine.
The moment many New Zealanders heard the words Pike River mine for the first time. Grey District Mayor Tony Cockshorn telling Checkpoint the early signs were not promising for the men trapped underground, the youngest, Joseph Dunbar, aged just 17. Things didn't improve over the next few days, with conditions inside the mine too dangerous for a rescue to be considered. Then 5 days later, the police said a second explosion had dashed all hopes of finding anyone alive.
Unfortunately, I have to inform the public in New Zealand at 2:37 today, there was another massive explosion underground, and based on that explosion, no one survived, and we are now going into a recovery mode. I've had to break the news to the family, and they're extremely distraught. I was at the mine myself when this actually occurred, and the blast was horrific.
Today, 114 families and friends will make the trip back up to the portal of the mine, deep inside the Paparoa Ranges. The ongoing recovery effort will be paused, and at 3:44, the time of the first explosion, there'll be a minute's silence, followed by a roll call where the names of the men will be yelled down into the mine. Bernie Monk, who will shout out the name of his boy, Michael, has been at the forefront of efforts to get back into the mine.
There was quite a few years there we weren't even allowed to go to the portal, and then we finally got our, you know, we got our way, and now... there's a lot of the family members have actually walked down into the mine. So, you know, slowly we're getting there.
Despite Pike Recovery Minister Andrew Little saying it's too risky to go beyond the rockfall, where the men most likely are, Bernie Monk is not ready to give up hope of one day being able to give his son a proper burial.
People have said that we're never going to go through the rockfall, but, you know, there's still a chance that could happen. I mean, they've made these calls outside the mine, and all the experienced miners that I've talked to, both here and overseas, say to me, Bernie, you can't judge a rockfall till you actually stand in front of it.
Chloe Nepa lost her husband, Kane, in the tragedy. She won't be making the trip up to the portal, preferring instead to visit the memorial at Ataro at the turnoff to Pike River. She's had to raise their son, Kalani, by herself for the past 10 years, and says it doesn't feel like a decade has already gone by. Kalani was just 19 months old when Kane died.
Kalani's been my rock, so he's actually kept me going, to be honest with you. Like, I don't know where I'd be without him, to be honest. Like, he's definitely my medicine, and he makes me get on with it and do what I have to do. So, no, I'm very, very lucky I've got him.
After visiting the memorial today, Chloe and Kalani will head to their own special place to remember Kane.
We're lucky enough that the boys at the Kahuna Water Ride Surf Club, they made a seat for Kane and Glenn Cruz, where Kane and Glenn used to surf at the surf club, so we've got a seat there that we go to, and that's where we do our little thing.
Members of the public wanting to mark the day will be able to join in a service at Blackball at the Museum of Working Class History, where a number of family members will also gather. There'll also be an official event at Parliament involving other family members, the Prime Minister, and the husband of the late Helen Kelly, who joined in the fight to see somebody held accountable for what happened at Pike. Mō te hōtaka o te ata, ko Conan Young tēnei.
Meanwhile, the Director General of Health, Ashley Bloomfield, says until vaccines arrive, elimination remains the strategy.
The first ones will come online, we think, around the first quarter next year. That's the Pfizer vaccine that we've already announced previously. And then this latest Janssen one is third quarter of next calendar year. In the meantime, and until we've got a high population coverage, the overall strategy does remain elimination, which of course means we want to keep the virus out of our communities. And if it does get there, then we do this quite rapid response and stamp it out.
Does that create issues with messaging and complacency?
Well, what we have seen this year, of course, is that when we're in alert level one and life feels back to normal, then we have to constantly remind ourselves to do those basic things like, scanning them with the app, the basic hygiene measures and so on. But what we also need to be aware of, and we've had plenty of examples now, is that this virus is rampant around the globe, but we will still see people coming across our borders with the virus, and occasionally we will get an incursion. And what our aim is, and we've done that successfully in the last few occasions, is without having to go up alert levels, deploy other measures. And one of those, of course, is the measure being rolled out in Auckland from today, the use of masks on public transport and on flights around the country.
Yes, I'll get to that just shortly, but one more question on vaccines. Are you worried about vaccine resistance, those who are opposed to it, and what sort of levels they might be at, and how might you counter that?
Well, I think what people want to know is, first of all, are we in the game to get vaccine? And the announcement overnight and our earlier one shows, yes, we definitely are. I think people will also want to know that the vaccine is safe and effective, and they'll want to know who's getting it first and why. And so the really big opportunity for us, of course, is to communicate this really well with the public. Communication, good communication, has been at the forefront of our response right from the start. And so there's a lot of effort going in to make sure that people are confident about the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine, and that they understand the importance of getting high rates of vaccination across the population. So we'll be working very hard on that. My own experience in the issue of vaccine hesitancy or refusal is that the number of people who refuse is actually very small ultimately, if they have really good information, if they have confidence and trust, and that's what we will be looking to build.
And would you expect that to be the same level as it already is for other vaccines?
Well, that's definitely our hope. We need to get, I would have thought, somewhere up over 80% to start to get a good population immunity effect. But our goal for childhood immunisation rates is 95%, and we should be aiming for a similar rate with this vaccine.
On the cluster, the recent cluster in Auckland linked to the Defence Force, has there been any progress in trying to establish what caused the link between cases A and D?
Nothing to reveal at this point, but ongoing intensive investigation just to see how that might have happened. And at the moment, it's still a puzzle. The important thing, of course, is that the case D, the young woman, did exactly the right thing, you know, when she was symptomatic and got tested. And so it was absolutely fantastic. We found out about that case early on and were able then to put in place measures to prevent further spread. We are very keen to find out if the way she got infected can be identified, because that will help us enormously, but at the moment no further lead.
Are you still considering the possibility that there is another link in the chain, that there is another person between A and D?
We haven't ruled that out. However, the whole genome sequencing, which shows a direct match, makes it less likely that there is someone in the chain of transmission between A and D, as does the timing. So we haven't ruled it out, but it seems unlikely.
Do you feel like you're out of the woods, though, with this particular cluster? Is it looking positive?
We would need to wait a few more days to be very confident about that. There are two things that are giving us increasing confidence. First of all, we haven't identified any further cases amongst the wide number of close contacts who are in isolation and are being tested regularly and are in isolation for the full 14-day period. But secondly, there's been high rates of testing around Auckland over the last few days, and I want to thank people for stepping forward and being tested, and we're not identifying any further cases there. However, we still do want to emphasise the point that anyone with symptoms and those people who were at those locations of interest, if they were there during the time periods said, then we're asking them to get a test, whether symptomatic or not.
On the issue of masks, are you hopeful that you'll see pretty much full compliance today?
Look, I'm very hopeful and I have no reason to think otherwise. We saw that when we were in alert level two earlier in the year, August, September, that when asked to or when required to, people did mask up. And in fact, I know in recent days, even without the requirement to wear masks, that many, if not most people, have been, not just on public transport in Auckland, but on flights around the country. So I don't think there's going to be a problem there.
Is there ongoing consideration of extending that to the public transport in other centres?
There is definitely consideration of that. We're in the middle of pulling together advice with our colleagues from across government, and we will be providing that advice to Cabinet in coming days, and then they will make a decision. I don't want to preempt either the advice or the decision.
What about taxis? Is that being given any more thought?
Well, at the moment in Auckland, with this new requirement, drivers of taxis and Ubers are expected to wear masks. There's no expectation on passengers, but that is one of the settings that we will be looking at. I think the other important point to make here is balancing the use of masks on transport with other settings that we know might be in be high risk, and those are closed, crowded, close contact spaces. So we have to make sure it's a balanced approach.
So just to confirm, so you will look at the taxi issue again? You are looking at that?
Well, we're looking at transport per se, so that includes flights, public transport and taxis and Ubers, just to see what the ongoing use of masks might need to be, either in Auckland or elsewhere in the country.
And that was the Director General of Health, Dr. Ashley Bloomfield. ACT's plan to roll back gun legislation is facing the cold, hard facts of political reality. Pro-gun policies helped ACT achieve an election surge, but Labor's new police minister is firm that no conversation is planned. Calls for a gun register, which ACT opposes, have been hardened by two recent shootings in Northland of police officers and the killing of an Auckland officer in July. Political reporter Yvette McCullough has more.
ACT is proportionately one of the most armed caucuses, with around half of its MPs holding firearms licences. Michael Dowling, who heads the Council of Licensed Firearms Owners, suspects this isn't the biggest representation the gun lobby has had in Parliament. It's just the most open.
We probably had the representation before. It's just for this election, people disclosed that they were licensed firearm owners.
Mr. Dowling says in its haste to make things safer following the Christchurch terror attack, the government has targeted legal gun owners and not criminals. So with the lobby group's former spokesperson, Nicole McKee, now sitting in Parliament, is he hoping the pressure will be on to roll back changes?
No, pressure is not what we're looking for. We're looking for an open conversation, evidence-based.
Mr. Dowling says they have to work within the existing laws, and what they want is for it to be easy for people to comply.
That's really our hope with Nicole, that all the experience she's had will help with evidence-based decision-making.
Ms. McKee has been a public champion of gun owners' rights since the March attacks. She says they're being made to feel responsible for the actions of a terrorist. Ms. McKee says the planned gun register should be scrapped.
It's not going to keep New Zealand safe. It's going to be very costly to the taxpayer with really no effect at all.
Ms. McKee says the government must also release the report of the Royal Commission into the Christchurch attack when it is handed over next week. And she believes the government should rethink its reforms based on the report's findings. But facing the reality of politics and opposition, Ms. McKee plans on taking a slowly approach, knocking on doors and building relationships.
Look, I think if I was to put a bill in tomorrow, the doors would be closed. But we are actually in a place where we should be able to have these honest conversations about achieving mutual goals.
Police Minister Potter Williams declined an interview, but in a statement says while she will always look to build consensus, she has no specific plans to work with ACT on firearms law, and no plans to review changes to firearms legislation. She says it's clear that the vast majority of gun owners are law-abiding, and she will continue work begun last term on licensing and administration, as well as firearms prohibition orders. Despite this, Ms. McKee is optimistic her voice will be heard.
Well, I'm hoping that as one of 120 that have been elected to come into here, that I would have the respect of my fellow colleagues to actually be listened to.
Potter Williams says she will be taking some time to ensure Cabinet gets the best advice, and there's no fixed time frame on the next steps. She adds that several Labor MPs hold firearms licences, and it would be incorrect to assume that any one party represents or speaks for firearms owners. From Parliament for Morning Report, Yvette McCullough.
Now, RNZ's text line lit up yesterday after the new tourism minister, Stuart Nash, told Morning Report that he wanted to ban tourists hiring vans without toilets. The minister also wants greater focus placed on attracting rich holidaymakers when the borders open up, and would be quite happy to see fewer cash-strapped backpackers. That split opinion amongst listeners. Reporter Jordan Bond got in touch with a few of them.
Freedom camping is a hot-button issue at the top of the South.
Everyone, we're totally over it. We see people in the white vans or station wagons with a self-contained sticker. They'll be up at local parks and playgrounds. It's just awful. And because you wonder where they go to the toilet.
That's Sue Lindsay of Richmond near Nelson.
You know, it's a very difficult situation because you want to be hospitable and welcoming, but you don't want your park trashed. And quite often we're picking up the rubbish after these people. It's only a small, probably, proportion that do, but it just spoils it for everyone.
Vivian Daly agrees. She's travelled a lot of New Zealand and has regularly seen tourists not paying at campsite honesty boxes and using amenities for free. She says we're being ripped off and wants tourists to pay more at the door.
People see us as a cheap place to come to where they can spend quite a lot of time and not spend much money. And while I understand the people wanting to do that, I just think that we're undervaluing what we've got to offer here and underselling it, and we're letting it go for nothing.
The country last year lifted the cost of coming here, a $35 international visitor, conservation and tourism levy. The pre-COVID estimation of it generating $90 million a year was meant to be split 50-50 between conservation and tourism infrastructure. An expat American, Larry, now in Tauranga, says he started as a backpacker, ended up staying, and for the last 50 years has been a New Zealander.
I have a lot to do with backpackers here in the summertime, and they're genuine people. They're like me. You know, they were only curious about New Zealand. I would have gone straight on to Australia and probably forgotten about the place. But most people I find who come here want to stay longer, and then they'll probably come back.
Natalia Yates owns a small shop in Dunedin and used to live on the West Coast and dealt with a lot of good backpackers. She says her business, the Felt Princess Wool Shop, is often visited by backpackers and not those luxury travellers who go to the big attractions.
Those high-end customers, they're really good for the high-end range of tourism. But there's all of these other little companies around the country that do get the other backpackers. They stop in at places like my shop.
The head of the tourism industry body, Chris Roberts, says backpackers are also important because they actually fill critical roles in tourism, hospitality and horticulture.
So they do come here for a long time. They work, they spend the money that they earn working, and they go away from New Zealand being ambassadors for our country, raving about their time here, encouraging other people to come to New Zealand and likely to come back themselves as adults and then be those high-paying, high-value tourists that we want.
Mr. Roberts says they've been looking at freedom camping issues for a number of years and there's no simple solution. Banning vans with no toilets, as Minister Nash proposed, is not one of them.
Look, I think the Minister's demonstrating a passion for his new portfolio and that he really wants to get in there and make a difference. So that's great from our point of view. We'll look to give him some more information. We're all wanting to solve the problems that have been around and make sure that we have a fantastic industry in New Zealand. Now, I think we can achieve a lot with the new minister.
Chris Roberts says one way to help is to make non-self-contained vehicles park overnight at campgrounds or dock sites, which have facilities. For Morning Report, Jordan Bond.
The Education Ministry is advising schools not to practice violent offender drills with their students because they might cause fear and anxiety. It also told them that teachers can't stop parents taking their children from classrooms during emergency lockdowns, but confirm they can take children to the toilet. The ministry's published guidance and legal information that it's been developing since the Christchurch mosque murders in 2019 prompted a lockdown of the city's schools and early childhood centres. Here's our education correspondent, John Gerritsen.
The mass lockdown of classrooms in Christchurch last year was unprecedented and highlighted problems such as what to do about toileting and how to handle angry and sometimes violent parents wanting to collect their children locked down against a potential attack. Now the ministry has published guidance on preparing for emergencies as well as responses to legal questions raised by the lockdown. Phil Holstein from the Canterbury West Coast Secondary Principals Association says a good number of parents turned up to collect their children during last year's lockdown.
Schools in their position weren't sure what to do in that because we were told that we were required to keep all our students on site and inside. So there was a tension. So now for us, it's far more clearer now. We are able to do that, but in a controlled manner.
Shane Buckner from the Canterbury Primary Principals Association says schools have been asking for clear guidance on what they're allowed to do in such situations, but says letting parents collect children could be tricky.
It is somewhat surprising, especially if you put yourself back into that lockdown situation where they don't want mass groups around. So if you suddenly have a whole lot of people coming to a school, then you're actually creating a big crowd anyway.
Denise Torrey from Somerfield School says it's good to have the guidelines. She says toileting was a problem for many schools during the 2019 citywide lockdown.
We had children using buckets and plastic bags, which was probably more distressing than trying to get to the closest toilet. So I think the ministry has listened to some of the comments made by whānau and schools around us and thought, what's actually sensible and what can we do safely?
But she doesn't agree that schools should not practice violent offender drills with their pupils. The guidance says it could cause undue fear and anxiety. Denise Torrey says her school does 3 drills every term for fire, earthquake and lockdown, and they're a good way to spot any flaws in its planning.
Because we do drills regularly, we find we don't have anxiety in our school. Our kids understand that these are important for their safety. We make a competition out of it and they go like clockwork, but it is really to find out the anomalies of what could happen, and today we found one of those anomalies.
The ministry's guidance says the best defence against attack is prevention. It says that includes an engaged community where people feel safe and are willing to seek help if they're worried about someone's behaviour or state of mind. Mō te hōtaka o te ata, ko John Gerritsen tēnei.
New Zealand's regional economies have bounced back from COVID-19 better than expected. Figures to September produced by Infometrics show an economic activity bounce in regions such as Tasman and Northland, which were both up at least 3% on the same quarter last year. However, metro areas continued to struggle, along with regions that are heavily reliant on international tourism. With us now, Infometrics economist Gareth Kiernan. Kia ora.
Good morning.
Now, the results here, are they a surprise that the economy in some places seems to be doing pretty well?
Yeah, I mean, I think the rate the economy has bounced back this year across much of the country, I mean, it has surprised everyone, the strength of it, but certainly showing through in many of those provincial areas where they're not heavily reliant on international tourism. They've got a good, strong agricultural base, and we know those exports are generally still doing well. And then also those areas often benefiting from the increase in domestic tourism and travel that we've seen.
So Tasman and Northland, I think, doing particularly well. Is that because they were coming off a lower base, or is it because of some of those factors you're outlining that they, you know, they weren't hit like Queenstown was?
Yeah, if we look back a year, I mean, you know, most of the economy was heading in the same direction and more or less the same rate. So it is a factor of just the changing conditions after COVID and how that has had quite an uneven effect on different parts of the country.
And what's driving it in those areas?
Yeah, the agricultural exports and incomes are still doing okay. But what we've seen, especially around domestic tourism, obviously with people unable to travel internationally, there's more holidays taking place within New Zealand. And the sort of pattern of domestic holiday making is quite different in some cases to international holiday makers. And so getting that money, a lot more people outside the main centres, and that's really helping to boost some of those regional economies.
What about construction? What is its part here, and what kind of construction are we talking about that is helping?
Yeah, we've seen construction, again, has been one of the strongest areas, particularly around residential activity, and we know how strong the housing market has been, and that's helping to fuel ongoing activity in terms of house building. That's occurring across much of the country, but that's one area where Auckland is probably doing relatively well is residential construction. Consent numbers and activity still going along strongly, but unfortunately, on the flip side, some of the commercial activity and construction activity there is just a bit softer, so that's sort of pulled down some of the Auckland numbers.
Yeah, the drop-off in Auckland and Wellington, how much of a concern is that?
There is concern there, especially because, there's no sign, of course, of international tourism returning in any numbers anytime soon. You've had something of a, maybe not a permanent shift, but certainly a shift that's going to hang around for some time in terms of people's working and spending patterns, and particularly in some of those metro areas, that is having an effect on how well businesses are doing and how well the economy is doing as well. So, yeah, there is major concerns, obviously, given that they are, you know, significant parts of the overall New Zealand economy.
Is this because people are able to more easily work from home and so they're not going into the office and therefore, you know, not going out and buying coffee or lunch or any of those kind of things?
Yeah, that's right. So you look at the numbers around central Auckland and central Wellington in particular, and they are quite soft as a result of that. And you are probably seeing some of that spending substituted away into, areas further away from those main urban centres.
Thank you very much. Gareth Kiernan there, Infometrics economist.
We'll go to Australia now because South Australia has introduced a strict lockdown for the next 6 days in a bid to quickly crush a cluster of 22 known infections in Adelaide. Health authorities are concerned that the city might be contending with a particularly insidious and virulent strain of the virus. The state's chief health officer, Nicola Spurrier, says the strain appears to have an incubation period of only 24 hours, with people becoming infectious much more quickly than elsewhere. The ABC's Gabriella Marchant joins us now from Adelaide. Good morning.
Good morning.
So just two cases were confirmed yesterday, so it seems a pretty strong response when you're not getting exponential growth, or are you? What's going on?
Yeah, we were, that's what our chief health officer told us yesterday when they announced really the strictest lockdown in Australia. This is stricter than the Melbourne lockdown that obviously went for a very long time, over 100 days. And then our health officer announced this very strict lockdown yesterday and afterwards announced only two cases, which did surprise some people. But what she explained was that they're quite concerned this is a very, very infectious strain. It has a very short incubation period, so 3 days of infectiousness, but you're infectious 24 hours after coming into contact with the virus. So it's a very fast spreading virus, and they are concerned about the level of exposure within the community from the Medi Hotel where this began. But I should say, in South Australia, we're very similar to New Zealand. We have not had really any restrictions. We had very, very minor restrictions up until now. And even in March, we only didn't really have a proper lockdown. We were just limited to 10 people in the home. So this has been a real shock for South Australians. And even as recently as on the weekend, we were all in bars. We were very free in our society. And now today we've woken up and we are not allowed to go out for exercise outside. The essential worker list is very small, so takeaways closed, cafes, restaurants, all that sort of thing. Basically schools are closed. We are apart from for essential workers. So we are going hard, but we are trying to go early. And the chief health officer says that is to prevent a really prolonged lockdown like we've seen in Melbourne and other places around the world.
Does South Australia have the contact tracing, the testing capacity of other states?
It does, and we've had very good contact tracing up until now. We had a couple of clusters that spread in the community earlier on in the year in the Barossa Valley and also at the airport. But what the chief health officer has told us is the difference is they were from international travellers, and it was very easy to contact trace. This specific situation is within the community because a community member who was working at a Medi Hotel became infectious and then infected a large family who then went about their business for about a week. So we've got directives to contact trace basically back to about 11 days ago. So that's how long it's been in the community. And so I think they've got the capacity, but Nicola Spurrier, our chief medical officer, says that basically we need this six-day circuit breaker to allow the contact tracers to get to these next generations of infection before they are spread around the community and it becomes out of control.
And are South Australians on board with this?
They are. They're very South Australians are very compliant, and so far there's been no issues as far as we can tell. Obviously, there was a big run on the shops yesterday and a big run on the bottle shops as well. I know I spoke to a local bottle shop owner yesterday, and because there was a rumour that bottle shops would be closed, they normally did $3,000, and before 6 p.m. they'd done $35,000. So there was a big rush yesterday to get some basics, even though shops and bottle shops are all staying open for groceries and alcohol. But, you know, this is unprecedented and it's something that we've never seen before. So people are taking it seriously and will be wearing masks outside and not exercising apart from in the home.
All right. Well, Gabriella, thank you very much for that update there. Gabriella Marchant from ABC in Adelaide.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.